The following talk was given at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on June 8, 2025. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good to be here. I think I probably, well, the last time I was here, I think, was for our dear friend Paul Courtney's memorial service. And I miss him not being here, as I'm sure we all do. So this morning, I'd like to dedicate this talk and express gratitude to all those who have cleared the path for us to be here today. This includes our spiritual and familial ancestors. It also includes all the beings who have occupied this space before us. The creatures who have lived here before humans came, the indigenous people who were forcefully ejected from this space, the Christian congregation that built this church building, Tagadagiri Roshi, Steve Hagen, and Norm Randolph, who created the practice container for us to enter into to discover our own true selves. May our hearts be filled with deep appreciation. So this morning, I'd like to talk about containers, wholesome and unwholesome. We find ourselves in different moments in both of these. Oftentimes, we have entered these containers unconsciously and blindly. And I want to start with reading, this is a favorite poem of mine. It's called Autobiography in 5 Short Chapters. Some of you might know this. The first verse is, I walk down the street. There's a deep hole in the sidewalk. I fall in. I am lost. I am helpless. It isn't my fault. It takes forever to find a way out. Second, I walk down the same street. There's a deep hole in the sidewalk. I still don't see it. I fall in again. I can't believe I'm in the same place. It isn't my fault. It still takes a long time to get out. Third, I walk down the same street. There's a deep hole in the sidewalk. I see it there. I still fall in. It's habit. It's my fault. I know where I am. I get out immediately. Fourth, I walk down the same street. There is a deep hole on the sidewalk. I walk around it. Fifth, I walk down a different street. And this poem is by a woman named Portia Nelson, who wrote it in 1977. And as I said, this is a favorite poem of mine, and I think it really captures our human experience. It's seemingly easy for us, and you have a clock there, oh yeah. It's seemingly easy for us to mindlessly walk down the street and fall into a hole. We're so unaware that perhaps we don't even recognize the hole we're in. Then on the first day, we look around and we see, then one day we look around and we see that we're in a hole and have a deep wish to climb out of it. This is the way-seeking mind, in Buddhist jargon called bodhicitta, the deep wish to awaken. And yet we fall into this hole again and again because we're not yet ready to climb out of this familiar place that, although it creates a place of difficulty, it somehow is really comfortable for us. The great effort it takes to climb out of the hole. Oh, excuse me. It takes a great effort to climb out of this hole. Good morning. So I think our attachment to the hole in some way is kind of like an addiction or an intoxication. It's a familiar place that's probably in some way is many ways unwholesome, but we're carried away from our own true selves because it's such a comfortable place to be. And it's a place to be to run away from our own true selves. So, okay, I'm sorry. So my husband had a very difficult drug addiction, and thankfully he's been straight for 29 years, 30 years now. So it's in our a little bit distant past, but he struggled a lot, and he went through treatment 4 times. He kept trying, and he kept jumping back into that hole. And then something that really saved him was he got arrested. And he had a choice to make because he could either keep going the way he was going and perhaps end up in prison. And at that time, we had 3 young kids. Or he could do something about it. And the insurance company person said to him that you've been through this treatment 4 times. You have the tools and know what to do, and we're not paying for another treatment go round. And so he had to create his own container. So I don't know who knows about treatment, but oftentimes when a person goes to treatment, there's a very tight container that's created for them. And it's created by the people running the treatment program. And the treatees don't really have much say in how it goes. And so the insurance company lady said, you know what to do. And so for the first time in his journey, he had a say in how the container was built. And so when he had some skin in the game, I think it really helped him to recover because he had to take ownership of it and he had to create his own container informed by all the 4 treatments he had had before and other experiences in his life, but then somehow make it his own. And so when he could make it his own, it was much easier to climb out of the hole and go down another street. So recently, well, I've had a very eventful year so I had a student who I had ordained who, like, in his process of getting ready for ordination, took a detour, and he had been diagnosed with glioblastoma, which is brain cancer. And this was a person who was an old Zen friend who called me suddenly out of the blue a number of years ago and said, "Would you ordain me?" And we had been friendly acquaintances before that. And so I agreed, and he came and practiced with us at Clouds for 6 months, and then I said, "You can start sowing your robes." And in that process, he was diagnosed with this, and he had a real life wish to want to be ordained. And so at Clouds, we made it happen. And so he had like 50 people sew stitches on his Okesa and people helping him all along the way. And he was ordained like 2 years ago, last May. And for the first year or so, he was pretty good. His mind was still pretty good, but then he started declining. And I instructed him, and he understood himself that for him, his dying process, living and dying process, was his teaching. And that's what he had to offer us. And so last February, on Valentine's Day, he died. And then in the middle of all of this, last summer, almost a year ago, that I was diagnosed and had a recurrence of my cancer. And so in some ways, my cancer was on the back burner while through Hokan's journey, although we informed each other. And so I had kind of a tough year. And so I started to really consume the sugar, and kind of very mindlessly, and I was in a deep hole, just eating and eating and eating all the sugar and different food, and I was heavier than I've ever been, and I just didn't care to change it for a long time. I just was very comfortable and familiar in that hole. And then for some reason, about a month ago, this app came up on my phone that I had used before, that's kind of a lifestyle and dieting app. And I decided that day, okay, I'm starting this right now. And so that day I started this thing with intermittent fasting and, letting go of sugar and this and that. And about 2 weeks into it, something popped up that said, after 2 weeks, you're kind of detoxifying yourself from the sugar and you'll have less craving and you won't be this hungry and this and that. And so it took a real effort to say, I'm gonna do this and to stick with it. And this has happened quicker than many other endeavors we do, but I'm not craving sugar and I'm not feeling hungry and I can go for a long time without eating and I've kind of reoriented myself and I'm walking down a different street. But it takes effort. Bodhicitta, the way-seeking mind, there needs to be effort, that goes hand in hand with our deep yearning for to be our own true selves, to find ourselves. In the third verse, we totally recognize what we're doing and very consciously jump into the hole, but immediately climb out. That can be called the mind of disenchantment. And so I'm in a study group with about six or seven other people, and we read different books. And right now we're reading this book called Choosing Compassion, How to Benefit a World That Needs Our Love by Anam Tupten. And I want to read you what he says about the mind of disenchantment. And this chapter is called The One You Feed. In Buddhist traditions, there is a state of mind that is called the mind of disenchantment. And I should say he's from the Tibetan tradition. The mind of disenchantment comes about when we look inside and witness the deep-seated thoughts and emotional patterns of our mind. Our mind has tendencies, habitual patterns of anger, fear, greed, hatred, and jealousy. When we look inside, we often see that our behavior is unconsciously ruled by these negative tendencies and habitual patterns of our mind. We come to the feeling that we are almost terrified by the power of the unawakened state of our own consciousness, which is called samsara. It is very useful to do this kind of reflection. It would be really nice if more people in the world did it too. Cultivating a mind of disenchantment does not sound interesting or enticing. However, I recommend that we all try this reflection now and then. Other spiritual practices like learning how to be happy and joyous sound much more productive. This one sounds almost counterproductive, yet it is an essential reflection for anyone who wants to change themselves. I strongly recommend that we each take this reflection and practice it in our everyday life. So when he said, you know, oftentimes when we hear the word disenchantment, we think of it negatively, that it's something we want no part of. But disenchantment, you know, you have dis and you have enchantment. And the way that Anam Tupten is using this word, enchantment is kind of like intoxication. And, or like a spell. So that we're enchanted and we kind of lose ourselves. And so disenchantment is letting go of this intoxicating feeling. And so I think it's lovely. You know, it's interesting to me. I'm just thinking of this. I think for Anam Tupten, or I know for Katagiri Roshi, that he, the dictionary was one of his favorite books. And he would look up words, and I'm sure he, Anam Tupten does too, look up words and see what they're what their primary meaning was before there's all these connotations. And so oftentimes with Katagiri Roshi, he would use words in a certain way that none of us would use. And it was so refreshing to get back to the root of the word. You can attest to that too. And it's like, oh, let's get back to the basics, you know? And so That's that. So chapter four is walking around the hole, and it's the cultivation of wholesome seeds. So it, in Buddhism, that we talk about the storehouse consciousness, which is often like metaphorically our womb, W-O-M-B, and that there's seeds, negative seeds and positive seeds, and we have a choice what to cultivate. And so it's called storehouse consciousness, and also the other term, I think, I'm not sure if it's Pali or Sanskrit, it's alaya vijnana. And I did a little Google search, and the AI came up with this stuff, but I think it's good. So storehouse consciousness refers to a deep unconscious level of consciousness that holds all past experiences, karma, and potential for future experiences. It's considered the foundation of individual existence and the source of the cycle of birth and death. And then in a longer description, this talks about the transformation through practice, you know, with our storehouse consciousness. The Yogacara school of Mahayana Buddhism emphasizes that through practice, such as meditation and mindfulness, we can learn to transform and transcend the storehouse consciousness. By understanding its influence and activity, engaging with our thoughts and actions, we can break free from the cycle of samsara, birth and death, and achieve liberation. So cultivation of wholesome seeds, when we take care of and nurture the wholesome seeds and let the unwholesome seeds wither away by not feeding them, we consciously pivot and walk down a different street. I love that word, pivot. So Katagiri, excuse me, Katagiri Roshi used the phrase, that's space where change happens. And there's nothing to grasp in that space, but there's an opportunity to turn our focus around. I've always enjoyed that phrase. So the container that is offered to us by Shakyamuni Buddha is his teachings. Throughout time, from then to now, these teachings have passed through many, many people. Each of these people have created a relationship to these teachings that is in some way unique to each of them and yet the same. We each need to spend time in the container offered, and as we digest and incorporate what is being offered, we have a hand in embellishing the container and passing it on to others to experience. I think that's what this is meant when the Buddha said, be a light unto yourself. Well, I know it's only 10:26, but this is what I have to offer you today. So I invite you all to... Please, if you'd like to speak from your heart about experiences you have that have been turning are pivotal for you to share with all of us, if you will, please. I might have to call on someone.
Hey, Neon. Can you tell, you sort of hit on this in your talk, and this something that I've found in my own life is we don't want to change. So, you know, I've fallen in the hole a few times, and at some point I think I like falling in the hole. I don't want to take a different street. I have no idea what that other street's like. I wouldn't know who I would be on that other street. I'm just going to keep falling in the hole. Can you talk about that, like sort of the resistance to, you know, whatever that unknown is of
right.
sort of avoiding the problem or improving yourself, taking care of yourself, but it's still kind of scary and wanting
yeah.
to stick with what you're doing.
Yeah. And some people stay in the hole a long time. Some people probably stay in their whole lives because of that fear. And yet, when there's moments of really looking around and seeing the environment of the whole, and you might say, I gotta get out of this place if it's the last thing I ever do. And, you know, and it takes energy and it takes courage and it takes people around us to support us. And it takes surrender. And it takes that thought that life is short. Is this how I want to live the rest of my life? And to put the energy into to say, no. And as the poem goes, that, you know, first you fall into the hole and it takes a long time to get out. And then you fall into the hole again and you still say, it's not my fault. It's everything else around me and somebody else is to blame for this, not myself. But as you keep going down and the next time falling into the hole because it's so familiar and it feels so good, maybe having that beer or that cookie or something else and saying, I don't care, I'm just going to do it, even though I know it's not the best for me. And so, but somehow I don't know how it happens. You know, something changes and say, okay, this is going to be the day that I do something differently. Like I was amazed for such a long time with my husband's addiction that one day he was using, the next day he stopped for the rest of his life. And I have no clue how that works and where that energy comes from. Although I did feel a little bit, I mean, just the taste of it, of when I said, this is the day I'm going to start using this app and maybe stop eating so much because I don't want to keep living this way and I want to eat healthy and I want to feel better and I want to feel not tired and I'm just going to do it. And then this app I'm using has a lot of support. And, you know, and there's just something individually I'm doing because my husband is still in the middle of his sugar thing. And there's all these sugary, crappy food around the house. And I just said, you know, and it's gotten easier as the blood sugar in my has gone down and it. So my body is supporting this practice and my mind is supporting it. And I still have to be careful. Like I was at somebody, a friend of mine's little concert yesterday, and afterwards they had refreshments on the table, and it was cookies. At first I said, oh, I can eat one cookie. And then I said, no. And so I can't tell you how it works, but I can tell you that if we have the discipline and the desire and yearning to change, if it gets strong enough, we can do it. And other people around us can help us. You're welcome.
My thing is reading fiction. And I have a pinched nerve in my back, so I've been reading lots of fiction. But I couldn't really do much else. But I've been reading too much even before that pinched nerve started. So yesterday I didn't read any fiction. So there's that. I did read a book, though, recently where the good guy, the detective, the police detective, was confronting the bad guy, the serial killer, who, and they had both gone to the same youth facility for people who were taken away from their parents or were orphans in Los Angeles. And so the bad guy was kind of looking at that. So we both went to the same place, huh? And you wound up there and I wound up here. Well, I must have fed the wrong dog.
The wrong dog.
Dog. They used to tell us, you've got two dogs, you can feed the good dog or the bad dog. And I must have fed the bad dog way too much. So there's that. I think that it's entirely possible to be of two minds about whatever, reading or eating or taking drugs. You know it's bad, but you like it. So it's really hard to stop when you like it and you don't want to quit, but you know it's bad. So you can have two minds, and then it just, you know, one day you decide, okay, I'm going to try to change. And maybe you get a little aware, maybe you don't, maybe it takes another time, whatever. It's like that.
And I think really it's kind of like being willing to, as he's saying, to check out our minds and to see what our intentions are. But, you know, he says the practice of seeing what's going on and looking at our thoughts and saying, you know, it's like, this is what I want to do. Or instead of reading the book, you say, I think I'm going to go for a walk today. And that could just change something, you know? Like, but it's always there. We always have this choice of good or bad, and we always keep doing it until our last breath, you know? And there's this story of the Buddha, about Bhikkhu going to the Buddha and the Buddha talking about right action. And he says, well, you know those thoughts that you have that are good thoughts? And the Bhikkhu said, yeah. And the Buddha said, keep thinking them. And you know those things that you've done well, and that you're doing good things and wholesome things? And Bhikkhu says, yes. And the Buddha says, keep doing them. And then, you know those things that you've been thinking that
aren't very good for you that are kind of unwholesome, stop thinking about it. And also those things you've done that are questionable, just stop doing those things. And so, you know, and it's like, what are we, which seeds are we cultivating and let grow, and which are we let it wither in our storehouse consciousness? And, you know, and take, and it takes putting effort into being aware of our own self and what we're doing. Don't you think?
So this actually is my second time being at the center here.
Welcome.
Thank you. I first came here when my mom had first passed. That was 9 years ago now.
Oh.
And I'm just listening to this concept of walking the same street. And walking the street that's painful. And I guess I'm wondering, how do you get more comfortable with the uncomfortability? And when it's painful to try to take a different street, I don't know if that makes sense. Because I'm finding myself in the same cycle. And while there's a lot of love there, there's also a lot of pain that feels like it's also holding me back. I don't know if any of that makes sense, but how do you get more comfortable with the pain?
Well, I think one thing is to accept the pain and let it in and not have an aversion to it. Is to, I think my teacher had said to me when one of my parents died, is you have to feel that pain in every cell of your body and really let it in. And so that's part of it. Something I like to think about is there's the grief and there's gratitude. And I think grief and gratitude kind of are inseparable, that they rise together. And so there's the grief of having lost person and this gratitude that this amazing person was in our lives. And so, and that we were fortunate to have that person be in our lives. And so, you know, my mom has been dead for 27 years now. And she died on Mother's Day, which is like, oh my God. But there's times I think of her and I can still cry. There's other times I think of her and I have a big smile on my face. And so I think the grief and pain will never completely dissipate, but it gets digested. And so when it's digested, it isn't carrying us away. It isn't enchanting us. So there's a way to get disenchanted from the pain you feel and not wallow in it. So, and this is what I found with my own experience. And
Hi. Hey there.
One of the things that I kept thinking about during your talk was the concept of impermanence and how Katagiri talked about impermanence and the fear of impermanence, of facing, and how that is perhaps one of the basic reasons we stay in the hole, because we don't want us to really face that part of who we are. So perhaps you could speak to that a little, if that makes sense.
Yeah. We don't want to change, do we?
Yeah, I started this practice when I was 22 years old, and now I'm 67. And there's a way I don't like it one bit, and there's another way I don't ever want to be 22 years old again. So, you know, or just looking in the mirror and I see this old lady, you know, it's like, I don't want to be old. But there's some way I'm old and some way I'm not old. And at the same time, if I wasn't old, I probably wouldn't have grandchildren who I love very much and adore. And, you know, and so I think sometime you just have to let go of aversion to change. And I don't know what else to say about it. But what do you think?
Well, I think that it's pretty scary to think about impermanence. And it's not only about dying. Because, you know, but we still put off dying. You know, it's like, well, not today. So I'm not going to think about it. But everything arises and falls every moment. And so to me, finding that center space of acceptance of well, the things you cannot change, but, and one of those is impermanence, and that we are, at the same time, we're always part of the energy field of the universe. And, to accept that part of ourselves that, you know, when it's over, you're just a different form of yourself. I don't know. I just, that's what's in my mind right now.
So have you seen that movie Thelma?
Oh, years ago.
Okay. So, you know, so you have this old woman who doesn't want to go into the nursing home and, you know, she has this grand adventure when somebody has scammed her and whatever, and her grandson lives with her. Or, you know, checks in on her. And towards the end of the movie, she and her grandson are sitting on a park bench. You know, when she's accepting where she is and getting ready to go to a senior living facility. And she said something like, I'm not afraid of dying. What really gets me is not being around to see what happens next. So to not see her grandson getting older and to not be part of it in that way anymore. And that's, you know, that really kind of touched me. Like not being a participant anymore is kind of the sad part of it all. Okay. Is there anyone on Zoom who has anything to say? Hello, Zoom people. Okay. At clouds, we have a screen so we can see the people who are in Zoom land. I'll just imagine.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.